Hey, everyone. I'm your host, Kevin Kelly, and welcome back to Macro Matters, a research-driven podcast examining the key trends impacting both the traditional and digital asset markets. My goal is simple, to bring you behind the scenes with some of today's top investing minds as we explore novel ideas and controversial topic areas to make sense of today's investing environment. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto and digital asset space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item. Nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold securities or tokens mentioned on this podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. And with that, let's jump into the episode.
Hey guys, I wanted to tell you about our new sponsor, Crypto.com. Crypto.com's exchange is a rapidly growing trading venue with a strong retail flow. Top institutions can receive a credit line and highly competitive maker-taker fees. Their platform is robust, secure, and compliant. You can get started trading today on the Crypto.com exchange. And to get in touch with their institutional sales team, visit bit.ly/CryptoDelphi now or click the link in the show notes. Now back to our show.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We've got another exciting episode of Macro Matters in store for you. Today, I sit down with Sri Tiruvuthuntai, the Director of Research for the Jerome Levy Forecasting Center, an independent economic research and consulting firm. Sri is on my short list of must-follows, and his pragmatic approach to forecasting economic trends and business cycles is always a breath of fresh air. In this conversation, Sri and I discuss today's extraordinary policy regime, the growth profile of the U.S. versus the rest of the world, why the U.S. dollar could be poised for further strength, the struggles and headwinds facing the European economy, and what the post-COVID world is likely to look like, among several other notable topic areas. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Sri Tiruvuthuntai. All right. Well, I got Sri with me. Sri, really appreciate you taking the time. Glad we could catch up again. Excited for our conversation today.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
So we got a lot to get into. Let's start with the 30,000 foot view, though, and then we'll drill into some of these key themes that you're focused on. Right now, though, when you look at today's really, you know, I'll say complex global macro backdrop, where are you spending the most time, or what topic areas are you focusing, you know, a majority of your time on right now?
So, you know, here is the two key things, right? One is the COVID and whether it'll be finally behind us at some point, and what point will it be behind us? And the second is the policy response to it, whether it's adequate, whether it is strong enough. So if you look at the US, the policy response has been very strong compared with most countries in the world. Whether it is monetary or fiscal, we have had the strongest policy response. On the other hand, if you look at the COVID, control of COVID itself, we have done a relatively poor job compared especially with, I mean, not compared with Brazil and places like that, but certainly compared with Europe and East Asia, right? So I think those conflicting things are what's playing out to some extent right now. So if you look at Europe, for instance, the European mobility data and things like that, they're looking better than Europe. The US, they're clearly the second round of COVID is hurting activity. So it's not just the government restrictions. Even if there were no government restrictions, people are worried and concerned. You know, that's affecting. And that's driving a lot of the narrative with respect to things like dollar and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the monetary and fiscal, you know, response to this has been, unprecedented, obviously, right? That's kind of the go-to word everyone uses at this point, because that has just been so massive. What are the, and this is a conversation I really want to get into, because I know you do a lot of work looking across different countries and regions at things like debt to GDP ratios. You're looking at debt servicing to income levels. One of the kind of key topic areas right now that a lot of people are talking about is how we're going to see debt to GDP ratios, for example, especially in advanced economies, really kind of explode in the aftermath of this, right? Because of all that fiscal stimulus you were just talking about, trying to basically keep these economies afloat. One of the questions I have is when you look at things like the short versus long-term outlook for, you know, different asset classes and asset prices and just economic growth in general, what are the, I guess, longer-term consequences of some of the things that we're doing now? And you know, if let's say policymakers took a step back and they allowed some of this creative destruction to happen, would a period of deleveraging be something that could actually help prop up the longer term prospects for some of these countries? Or is this just something that we're kind of almost too far gone on, and the only real way to get out of this is you know, rapid or sizable currency debasement, things of that nature?
Right. I mean, this is a complex question because, you know, the policy thing is always tricky. You know, it's all very fine to say that, you know, let it all burn down and you'll have, and, you know, sometimes in ecology, and I make this analogy that sometimes it is good to let the small brush fires, you know, run their course. So you are actually more resilient. And that's very tricky to do in real time, you know, because any point in time, it's painful to do that. Right. And the problem is whenever you have these kind of, whether it's recessions or whatever, the people who bear the most brunt of it are the bottom 40%, right? I mean, you look at it and you see that the most vulnerable people have the biggest increase in unemployment and things like that. So I think that is really the issue, you know, when, and so then what we do is we try to patch up the brush fire, and eventually if the situation becomes bad, that you can't have a normal brush fire, you're going to have a huge fire no matter what, and maybe it will prevent an even huger fire later in the future. So that comes down to what are the fundamental things that causes this issue. It's not just a macroeconomic policy. What are the other reasons? And those are very complex. I mean, I have some ideas, but, you know, I don't think I have an answer to this. And I don't think there are easy answers to these things. And I think we should be humble about what we can achieve and whether we can, to some extent, some humility about being able to control our destiny completely, you know, is I think it's a good idea. I think be realistic about what can be done.
No, absolutely. And maybe we could take that in pieces too, because I agree. It's a very complex topic, and you go down any different rabbit hole and you'll have almost contradicting evidence that points you in one direction or the other. Maybe let's start with, because I know you guys focus a lot of your time, your focus on, you know, the idea of profits, profit maximization, and how that kind of ties in economic forecasting. And I mean, right there on your website, you have some really interesting ideas around how that is, I won't say a lost art in terms of economic forecasting, but oftentimes it's put on the back burner, or sometimes it's not really even included or thought of at all. So maybe we'll start with that. In the aftermath of you know, COVID and these economic shutdowns, how are you guys looking at the profitability profile, we'll say, of let's call it the US versus the rest of the world? And how do you tie in, you know, profit expectations or what you guys are seeing into your longer term forecasts, you know, for economic growth and things like that?
Right. So that's a very good question. So that's a good starting point where we can at least manageably answer that.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I think here is the key issue with profit. So, you know, capitalist economies are ultimately driven by profit because, you know, businesses hire and invest because they make good profits and they expect to make good profits, right? I mean, there are other considerations as well. Good profits doesn't mean that people will be investing if the demand is weak and the future prospects are not so great, you know. So even like we've had the last 10 years, investment has been fairly weak, even though profits have been overall fairly strong. So you can have a situation like that. So so where does COVID is obviously is a massive blow by itself to profits around the world, right? Because you're completely cutting off activity. If you cut off activity, profits are like, you know, very leveraged to activity, right? I mean, they are the residual of everything that flows in. So when you cut off activity, profits just completely get clobbered, right? If there were no government support whatsoever, profits would have been negative. It would have been like the Great Depression. We would have had no profits. It would have been losses in the aggregate. But around the world, we have had fiscal policy support. Obviously, we are not in the Great Depression world where we say, okay, let it all, you know, settle by itself. So that's where the fiscal policy comes in. The bigger the support, more you are propping up the profits, right? That's why part of our relative bullishness in the US compared to the rest of the world and the dollar and everything where we are out of consensus here is because US policy response, fiscal policy is much stronger. So let me take a step back and say how fiscal policy affects profits in the aggregate. Right? A lot of people have a micro view of profits, which is, okay, a business cuts profit, if it cuts wages, their profit is going to go up. Therefore, in aggregate, you know, if they're cutting employment, cutting wages, you know, downsizing, profits go up. That doesn't happen like that. Because if one business is spending less on their employees, those employees' income is going down. That income eventually goes back into spending on other businesses' revenue, as other businesses' revenue eventually, right? So if you're the business sector as a whole, if everybody cuts wages, then everybody's revenue is going to go down.
Because what you're basically saying is one person's revenue is another person's expense or another person's cost, right? So even if you have, you know, when you have mass job losses, like we're seeing right now, there are a lot of secondary indirect effects of that, because you're now seeing a loss of not only personal income for people, but that trickles into things like consumer spending, which obviously is a huge part, especially in the US, of economic growth, right?
Exactly. Right. So, but what we have done here is, this is where the deficit comes in. The deficit replaces that income. So some for people, so they can continue to spend even if they don't have jobs. And it was remarkable how strong the deficit response here was. That personal income actually went up, when unemployment is shooting up like that. And the second aspect of it is, if you look at it, it's just so striking, is consumer spending among the bottom 20 to 40% is actually went up, was higher than where it was before, because you gave them income, replaced their income totally, almost. I think 60% of the people made more than what they were making when they were employed.
Because you had that extra $600 a week, right? They really actually ended up tacking on a lot for people.
Yeah. So that's what has helped profits to go up. The other way to think about it, which is the way we look at the overall aggregate flow of funds of profit. So when the government runs a deficit, what is it doing? It's taking in less in dollars than it is pushing out into the economy. So that means, by definition, other sectors in the economy, private sectors, are getting in more cash than they are giving out to the government, right? So that means it is some way or the other, it's either showing up as personal saving or it's showing up as corporate profits or both, a combination. Right? That's what we are seeing. We are seeing a huge increase in personal saving because many are not able to spend because of COVID restrictions, especially older people. But those who are spending is flowing into corporate profits, which is why profits are not as bad as they would have been otherwise.
Right. And you're also seeing a pretty sizable disconnect between, we'll call it, the haves and the have-nots, of which business models or companies actually do prosper in a situation like this, right? The silver lining for them is you have this work from home, more virtual digital economy, so to speak, or an acceleration of that trend, versus the have-nots, which are, again, some of which are zombie firms that, you know, arguably probably should have gone bust a long time ago. But there is an argument to be made that a lot of small businesses, again, don't have the same type of access to capital markets as some of these larger incumbents. So you're seeing that large kind of disparity between the two only get worse and worse through this.
Exactly right. I mean, of course, the our aggregate level profits perspective doesn't really throw light on, you know, the sectoral distribution that you're talking about. But, you know, we can see what's happening. Clearly, the shutdown is obviously helping the online business. It's accelerating some of the trends that were already there, like Amazon taking share from retail, from the brick and mortar. It's just, I mean, push into an even higher gear, right? And you can see the devastation for small businesses. But it's not just the online versus brick and mortar. It's also the large versus small, the haves versus have-nots, right? So even among small restaurants, the ones that are being able to thrive are the large ones who obviously have the cash buffer and the ability to weather this, number one. And they have been able to make the transition to take out much more easily, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you saw McDonald's today, but, you know, I'm looking around. There are small businesses, probably they're not equipped as well. And, you know, it's harder for them to make that transition seamlessly. They may not have the exact location, storefront, parking, you know, all those issues that are needed for making that transition. So around me, I see, you know, lots of takeouts happening. Most of it is chain, not so much the mom and pop restaurant, you know, which are struggling. And that, you know, you're seeing the haves and have nots. That's perfectly correct analogy.
Right. And I think the restaurant industry is a great example of also this kind of disconnect between, I think, policymakers and small business owners. And this isn't to say, again, painting a broad brush, that all policymakers don't have necessarily that direct business experience. But when you talk about things like shutting down restaurants, right, or saying you have to operate at 50% capacity, some at 25%, or kind of easing back into this, there are very few, even you know, popular restaurants that can operate at that level of capacity, right, or lack of capacity, because margins are so thin in an industry like that, right? So it's, again, the disconnect, I think, just between policymakers and what's going on in the underlying economy is why you're continuing to see more and more fiscal stimulus, because, you know, certainly there's ways in which this can be a more efficient process to get money in the hands of people who actually need it, whether it's small businesses or people on the lower income or wealth scale. But I don't know if you have any thoughts around just the way in which, I guess, policymakers have handled this so far, if there are ways in which we can make that process more efficient, or if this is just not the time to really be trying to sort out, you know, who gets what, and really just kind of open up a shotgun approach, because the alternative is arguably an acceleration of monetary growth, because you're going to have to end up plugging these holes anyway.
Right. I mean, I think policy in terms of crisis, whether it is war or any other situation like that, you know, you have to be realistic about what can be achieved. The speed and the scale of policy is more important than the efficiency of each individual measure, because you just can't do everything at that time. And time is of essence, right? So in terms of the PPP, you know, if you ask around small businesses, many people that I have talked to, you know, most of them have actually gotten significant help. I think most people who wanted it have gotten the help. So, but the underlying problem is so severe that, you know, it's just not inadequate. It's not adequate. That's the problem. Okay. So that's one thing I would say. I would say that if you compare it to past episodes, we have been really fast in acting and also throwing the kitchen sink at it and throwing a huge amount of stimulus at it, right? So it's not, I wouldn't blame policy. I mean, could it be done better? I'm sure there are ways and means. And as you point out, right, I mean, the small businesses' problems are very unique and very difficult. And maybe things could be done better. I don't discount that. But at the same time, I think if you see in the broad view of how policy gets done in crisis, this is not actually terrible.
Right. And at least to a good point, you mentioned this earlier, kind of the difference between the fiscal policy responses within, let's say, the US and Europe, right? And how it's been so drastic and so large, and the speed of which, you know, it was enacted was very, very quick. And that obviously is a bit of a contrast to what's going on in Europe. Maybe let's dig into that a little more, and it would be great to hear what your kind of outlook is on the relative growth profile going forward of the US versus Europe, how fiscal stimulus response has kind of played into that, and what your thoughts are there.
Okay, so let me just say one more thing on the policy. I mean, if we have done terribly on policy, it is probably on the health side, which I'm concerned, and I can't say much about it. But clearly, why are we doing so much worse on COVID control, which would actually help small businesses the most? Control COVID, you know, then, you know, small businesses will come back. I mean, the setback has been really bad, you know. Mm-hmm. And why have we done poorly? I mean, I don't know. I'm not an expert on that aspect, the health, public policy, public health. And clearly, we are not doing something right. I mean, and so that's really the issue here. Okay, in terms of fiscal policy, see, if you look at what's happening right now, and a lot of people are getting excited about Europe, is that temporarily they are looking better because they are not closing down like we are, you know, and they are looking better. And that's probably going to last for until we get some modicum of control on COVID. But looking beyond that, so, you know, the European fiscal policy is, the stimulus is about half our size. Okay. And they probably, and all the talk is about how they have gotten this great, you know, thing, fiscal, what do you call that? The Euro, joint Euro bond, you know. Oh, that's
such, yes, a, yeah.
Yeah, fine. It's an important step. I don't want to minimize it. But there is still a lot of ways to go before they open the purse strings. And I would like to see how much they are talking about. $700 billion over 5 years. We are doing $2 trillion this year, you know. Right. And, you know, and the 700, 800 billion, whatever number it is. And you know, there is veto power for each of the governments. In terms of that policy, in terms of that's like saying that every senator has a veto.
That's a really important point to address too, right? Because the headlines will lead you to believe is you now have this, you know, you're basically essentially a European Union or the European Commission going to the bond market to raise money in aggregate for the EU, right? And
exactly.
And it is one of those, and for a period there, you know, it was one of the things where people were starting to call for the, not only the downfall of the euro, but the complete destruction of it, because you have, again, a unified monetary policy, a very fragmented fiscal policy by definition. And so to your point, even though you've seen, you know, this, we'll call it for Europe, a relatively massive new fiscal rescue package passed, it still hasn't technically passed until you have it go through and get ratified by all these different individual governments themselves, right?
Right. Exactly. And so, there is another issue. So if you look at the European economy over the last 10 years, here's what they have done. Here's how they have gotten out of jail. They got into problem with a little bit of lag after 2008 with the sovereign debt crisis, right? So here is what they did. They decided to export their problem away, bigger thy neighbor, essentially. All of them started to become Germany, essentially. Germany started this process way back in 2003. Right. So all of them post 2010 adopted the German model. Okay. So let's run current account surpluses. Okay. And that's how we will get out of our problem. So the euro area, if you look at it, they have actually adopted fairly tight fiscal policy during this period of time and running current account surpluses. Right. So, but that actually transfers the problem on the rest of the world, which is why, you know, EMs have seen worsening of their own balance sheets. But it also creates vulnerability. Now they have a huge amount of exposure to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the world has to be doing really well. Now, COVID has been a huge blow to the entire world economy. Plus, we have deglobalization, China trade war, all other things that are going on in the background. You know, those stuff is also there. They're all adding, they're synergistically growing those problems. And what that does is it is a body blow for Europe's major strength during the last 10 years, which is the huge current account surplus. So if they're not going to be able to export and they still need to import whatever they need to import, that takes away a major part of their pillar. It's a pillar of expansion. And here is, I'll say, make one point. A lot of people will tell you, they look at it from a GDP perspective and they tell you, oh no, the trade is not contributing to GDP. That's a very bad way to look at it. You know, this is where the profits perspective, the flow of funds that we look at, is so much more useful way to think about it. So if you think about the flow of funds that make the profits in the aggregate, okay, this is not, again, the micro view of I'm cutting wages. I mean, that fallacy. So the current account surplus is an addition to profits in the domestic economy. So the bigger surplus you run, the more profits you're running. Okay, so if you take away the current account surplus, you're giving a big blow to the European profits, because the current account surplus is almost as big as the entire European euro area profits from, you know, the national accounts, not from the operating earnings. I mean, not the official earnings that comes out, the MSCI earnings. So that's a big problem for Europe.
Right. And that ties into, again, the relative value, or I should say the relative, let's say, growth rate of profits in Europe versus the US, which again has a ton of effect not only on economic growth, but also on, you know, asset prices, like looking at, you know, stock market performance between the two regions.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's it is not, I mean, people keep looking at this mean reversion. Okay, tell me what is going to drive the mean reversion. It just doesn't drive happen by itself. You know, ultimately, is it going to be driven by relative GDP growth, relative profit performance? What's going to drive? Okay, yeah, this is off the charts, but there is a reason for why it is off the charts, because the profit performance is different.
Right. And one of the things, you know, I think you're alluding to here as well, as you mentioned, a few of the other potential headwinds that are brewing in the background, right, which have seemed to almost, you talk about the U.S.-China trade war, for example, which was obviously top of mind for everybody heading into the end of last year. COVID comes around and you almost hear nothing about it for months on end because, again, we're going through a global pandemic. So it's not like it's totally been erased from the memory of every investor's mind. But my point being, there was a lot of talk in the early days about a V-shaped recovery, right? And the odds of a V-shaped recovery. And now we're looking at things like K-shaped recoveries and basically any type of letter you can think of, you can probably make the argument for. But even if we did hypothetically, let's say, get a V-shaped recovery, right? Which we know at this point is just out the window. But let's say hypothetically we did, it's not like getting back to pre-COVID levels and had COVID never happened and all of these mandatory shutdowns happened, it's not like the path for global growth, right? We can get into where or which regions specifically, but overall in aggregate, the path of global growth was trending lower. And it's not like we were going gangbusters on the growth front before this, right?
Exactly. You know, that's a very good point. It's not like the world was in great shape before COVID. You know, there is this thing, oh, we were doing... So that itself was a problem. And then, you know, even if we get, let's say, COVID just vanishes tomorrow. In the interim, the damage done to a lot of businesses, most business sector is going to end up with much higher leverage post-COVID than even if tomorrow, completely went away, we all went back to business, they're all going to have higher leverage than they did. Because we have high operating leverage, no cash flow, leverage is going to go up even more. That's what is going to happen. This is true, especially in the non-US world where the policy response has not been as strong, right? So the income replacement has not been strong, which means people have had to spend more than they had, draw down on their buffers or take loans, right? So you look at places where there's tourism, you know, what are the hotels are highly leveraged businesses. What's happening there? Airlines, we're seeing that in the US, but around the world as well. So at the very least, you are going to end up with a world where there's going to be a ton more leverage and in the private sector, and everybody's going to try and deleverage, which is going to be a headwind at the very least. On top of that, you're also going to have banking system deal with a lot more leveraged entities. Temporarily, they have given all moratorium. They may even give, you know, some relief on, you know, the stress tests and things like that. But the fact is, banking balance sheets are not going to look good at the end of it. So they're also going to be tightening standards, which they already are. You can see that. So even if everything went well, we still would be in a weak growth environment post-COVID. And it's not as if the pre-COVID environment was great to begin with.
Hey guys, I wanted to tell you about our new sponsor, Crypto.com. Crypto.com's exchange is a rapidly growing trading venue with a strong retail flow. Top institutions can receive a credit line and highly competitive maker-taker fees. Their platform is robust, secure, and compliant. You can get started trading today on the Crypto.com exchange, and to get in touch with their institutional sales team, visit bit.ly/CryptoDelphi now or click the link in the show notes. Now back to our show.
No, absolutely, 100%. And sticking to that point of the amount of leverage in the corporate sector, right? Private sector, but I know you've mentioned it's not so much households this time around. The explosion you've seen in corporate debt has been massive, especially if you compare it to underlying economic activity in here in the U.S. What is, and I'll preface that this is probably a very subjective question and one that you may not be able to nail exactly, but what in your mind is kind of the pin that pops the corporate credit bubble? Is it something like this where you have this massive exogenous shock to revenues and therefore profits and cash flow, and eventually the market starts to just lose confidence in some of these companies in the high yield debt sector, investment grade debt? I mean, there's been $1.3+ trillion raised in the U.S. investment grade market alone this year, given the Fed backstop. What do you see as the potential catalyst for that deleveraging? And secondarily, what are the effects if we were to see such a sizable corporate deleveraging that it sounds like we would need in order to potentially spark, you know, longer term economic growth?
Right. I mean, so, you know, the amount of wall of liquidity plus the people, you know, I mean, when things ease down, and one of the things that my colleague David Levy wrote, The Bubble or Nothing, it's there available on our website for those who are interested. You know, this environment, because private sector portfolios, balance sheets are so large in relative to GDP, people have to hunt for capital gains. So when things calm down a little bit, people are immediately, the fear of missing out is huge, right? That's why you tend to see this massive chases for yield or for capital gains, like you're seeing in gold and silver, you know, so it's very, very powerful force. And you also see that in people migrating into private lending, private equity people getting into middle market lending, you know, because there are not enough organic investment opportunities. And that's what keeps the thing going, right? So it may not be so much as something tricks it, but it starts to just deflate on its own because, you know, the underlying fundamentals and everybody starts to pull back a little bit. You know, and you start deflating. Like if you go back to the what happened to the junk bond bubble in the 80s, I don't know whether there was a single moment where it tricked. It was a long period of deleveraging in the corporate sector. Started in somewhere in the late 80s, early 90s, went all the way to 93, 94. You could see that deleveraging went on for 3-4 years. So, you know, it's a process. And I don't know whether there is a moment or a trigger or a catalyst. I wish I could. I had the magic you know, crystal ball to see that. But those things are hard to predict.
Yeah, no, we if you had a crystal ball for that, we probably wouldn't be sitting here talking about it, right? Be on a beach sipping a mojito somewhere. But I think it's a great point and an area that, you know, we've spent a lot of our time focusing on as well, because it's such an interesting time, because there is just such a large amount of noise, but also a large amount of information, you know, an information edge you can get, I should say, from looking at kind of alternative data sources and really trying to figure out, you know, for lack of a better, what the hell is going on right now. What are some of the things that you guys are tracking to try and give you a real kind of pulse on the economic backdrop, right? And whether that's in the US, rest of the world, different regions, you know, I'll kind of kick that to you. But in general, are there any alternative data sets that you're finding to be more helpful this time around, just given how much noise there is right now about what's going on?
Right. I mean, of course, there is a proliferation of good and bad data, but there is a proliferation of data because we have big data, you know, so we have data on, for instance, credit card spending, but everybody's now putting up this pulse and tracking the recovery. So there is a wealth of data. You know, we are consumers of a lot of this. We don't produce the data ourselves. We do look at a lot of them. And some of these are quite helpful. I mean, like clearly the credit card spending data are very helpful. That which comes out from both BofA and also from JP Morgan. The JP Morgan Institute puts up some good stuff there. We also are looking at this tracking the recovery. Whose website is that? That's fairly good, I think.
Is that the Opportunistic Insights, I think, or Opportunity Insights?
Something like that.
Yeah, I've seen that.
That's fairly good. And
they kind of break it out by wealth or income levels, right? Like high income spending. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So those are some things that we track among the newer data feeds. I can't really say that I'm tracking anything other than that in terms of alternate data sources.
Yeah. So let's jump in. You mentioned the dollar earlier. It's hard to find a macro trade right now that doesn't kind of revolve around, or at least in some part is influenced by, the direction of the dollar, right? And, you know, we've talked a bit, you know, not only just in our work, but on this podcast with a few guests about kind of the entire global dollar standard, we'll call it, right? And the dominance of the dollar today. So it's not as something I want to rehash, but I do want to get your take on where you see the dollar going, because as we're recording this, right, we're recording this on the 28th of July, and we've seen the dollar, at least the dollar index, the Dixie, essentially kind of, you know, fall off a bit of a cliff here over the last week. I think it's on pace for its worst month since March of 2016. And so, but I know you've been on, I think it was a Real Vision interview within the last week or so with Mike Green, talking about how the dollar could potentially jump higher from here. Would love to get your take on, you know, what would cause that dollar strength, or why you think we could see further dollar strength after this recent sell-off. And do you have a separate view on the dollar versus other advanced or developing market peers versus, let's say, the emerging market currencies?
Right. First of all, I want to preface it and say these are not trading recommendations.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
So, I will, you know, because I hear some comments. Oh, do you don't say? No, I am not trading FX day to day, and you know, managing risk in that sense. I will say this about the dollar. You know, our view of the dollar is driven by fundamentals. What is the fundamental growth story? Is the rest of the world ready to outperform the U.S.? The real reason why the dollar has gone up since 2011, which was the bottom for the dollar, if you look at it in the charts, is because U.S. growth has outperformed, relatively speaking, the rest of the world. Relative outperformance. It's not the absolute growth levels are still lower, but even including the yen, it's the relative performance trajectory has changed in the last 10 years. And what is going to change that going forward? And I don't see anything, because first of all, we are doing a bigger stimulus, so we are going to come out of it eventually when COVID is behind us better than everybody else, number one. Number two, the private sector debt levels around the world, and we always look at private sector debt levels because that's what really matters for financial stability. Because the government debt, except in emerging markets where it's a different matter, the private sector debt levels in almost every developed country is higher than ours. Australia and Canada are off the charts, but even Europe, the debt levels are higher than our private sector, if you add the corporate and the household. So that's the second point. The third point is The rest of the world is dependent on us more than we are dependent on them, because we run a current account deficit, which means they sell more to us than we sell to them. So if everybody is going down, demand is a problem. They have a bigger problem than we have. They have
Absolutely. So would you say, and again, it's good to preface with the, I guess, the short-term time horizon versus the long-term time horizon, right? Because when you're talking about these different, and they're, again, not investment advice, not trade ideas, but the potential direction of things like the dollar and what that subsequently means for asset prices, it is always important to understand what the time horizon is. Do you think if we extend this out, let's say that we kick this out 10, 15 years from now, do you think the long-term structure of the dollar in today's global financial system, we'll call it, and the level of explosive debt to GDP levels we're going to see in the, we'll say in the public space, right, or the government balance sheet here, do you think that is going to weigh on the dollar long-term, and we're actually going to see the dollar be dethroned in a sense? And if so, or if not, then we'd love to hear obviously why. But if so, you know, is there another fiat currency that replaces it? Do we go back to countries looking, or at least smaller emerging countries looking at gold standards? How do you kind of see this monetary system playing out over the longer term, you know, beyond, let's say, the next, you know, 12, 24 months?
Right. Okay. So let me also make just a short-term point, which I made earlier, before I go into the law. So right now, part of the reason why Europe is looking better, as I said earlier itself, is they are coming out of, they don't have the resurgence in COVID. So all their short-term data is going to look much better for the next couple of months at least, you know, far better. You know, the domestic data is going to look better. Okay, so with that out of the way, so, you know, the longer term, you know, here is the question that always comes to my mind, you know, what replaces the dollar? When we are talking about the long term, what replaces the dollar? This was the question in the 70s as well, right? When, you know, the Bretton Woods broke up and it looks like, okay, the U.S. was really doing bad. You should go and look at the commentary during the 70s about the U.S., right? I mean, you know, first of all, when they brought down the U.S., the dollar is getting crashed. It was a long 10-year period. But again, what happened was we reestablished the supremacy of the dollar. Maybe it took Volcker, but I don't think it took Volcker. Even if Volcker hadn't happened, it would have happened. The reason why that happens is, at the end of the day, there are two things, right? The U.S. provides a large market globally, right? So nobody can afford to say, we don't want that market. This is not, you know, we don't want to sell in that market because we don't like the dollar, number one. Okay, number two, the U.S. also provides a large liquid market in safe assets, but overall broadly in financial assets. So global investors, whether they are looking for safety or whether they are looking for returns, you know, they can't say that I'm not going to have S&P in my portfolio, I'm not going to have. So that's, these two things are very big factors. How do you replace that? You know, I mean, if you look at the last 20 to 30 years, U.S. share of global GDP has come down, but our share of the financial asset has not, right? It's so big. I mean, the S&P market cap relative to the rest of the world. And you could call it a bubble, you could call it all kinds of things. But the fact is, these are global companies, you know, with enormous global power. What changes it? And I'm not seeing anything. I mean, I'm not seeing good arguments from the other side. It's just, okay, these guys are recklessly doing this, recklessly doing that. And I keep hearing about how Europe is going to take over. But where is the European takeover? I mean, this was the same story in the 70s as well. You know, I mean, it never happened. Largely because if you want to be the global reserve currency, ultimately you have to be able to do one or two things. Okay. One is either run large current account deficits, which allows the rest of the world to accumulate your currency one way, or your financial system creates, which is the old UK system, so UK way, that creates enough supply of the currency through capital account, the others are able to accumulate the euros, right? Now let's look at Europe. Okay, they don't want to run current account deficits because how did they get out of jail? By running current account surplus. They don't ever want to do that, okay? That's number one. Number two, what is their banking system? Is their banking system covered itself in tremendous glory in 2008, 2009? We saw that. And they still have a huge amount of banking assets. Can they responsibly supply euros to the rest of the world in a way that satisfies reserve currency requirements? I don't think so, because they are not in that shape. Let them. I just don't see how this is happening. And, you know, China is just laughable. Let's not even talk about it. I mean, who are these people? Who wants to keep their money in yuan assets? I mean, I won't know these people. Who are these people who wants to keep their money in yuan assets? And China is not running in any time interested in running a current account deficit. You know, for time to time, they run a trade deficit. That's because they import a whole lot of commodities. In manufacturing, manufactured goods, their surplus has actually expanded. It's increased. And their whole plan for China 2025 is about increasing that even more.
Right. And do you feel, on the China point, do you feel that the reach that they're extending, and whether that's these, you know, various loan programs or basically trying to support, I'll call it economic growth or capital investment in emerging and frontier markets, is there anything in that long term that you think, you know, it's almost one of those things where China is discounted, then all of a sudden it becomes this dominant superior power over the US? Or is that something that's not really on your radar, you think might be a bit overblown? Because I have seen arguments on both sides.
You know, I mean, look, these, if you look at closely at many of these Belt and Road programs, they end up saddening the respective countries with huge amounts of debt. You can see that in Sri Lanka, it has happened. But it's happening in many places in Africa. It's under the radar because nobody really talks about it here. Nobody cares about many of these countries because they're not investable and, you know, they're not big enough in the people, the investors' horizon. These are saddling. I mean, China behaved is basically, I mean, I don't want to use very strong words, but in many of these cases, it's not like the Marshall Plan or US aid plans in the 50s and 60s, where US gave tons of concessional aid to many countries, right? So that's not what they're doing. These are usurious lending terms in some ways, you know, and in boondoggle projects. And that saddens the countries with useless assets. I think in Sri Lanka, they have an airport and they have a port, but there's no traffic. And there's a huge amount of debt on it now, right? And that's really the issue. It's not geared as a synergistic, symbiotic, beneficial, mutually beneficial program. Of course, China will spin it differently, but you can look at the ground reality. It's not how that things are operating there.
Yeah. And back to the U.S. dollar and U.S. denominated assets, one of the things you mentioned about I think lack of global safe havens, right? And when you think about safe haven assets, I mean, treasuries are obviously right up there with your risk-free rate, or I think as Jim Grant has recently pinned it, the return-free risk on U.S. Treasury bonds. Do you think that the rise of, let's say, something like gold or hypothetically, you know, the long-term rise of something like Bitcoin or these other non-sovereign alternatives, if those are able to create or get large enough to create and absorb some of these global savings or the demand for safe haven assets, is that something that could threaten the dollar or the attractiveness of treasuries longer term? Or is it just something that you foresee the treasury market being as robust or as, I'll call it safe in quotes, as it is today for, you know, the foreseeable future?
I will say I'm very biased because that's our biggest position, treasury. So that's our thesis.
It's been a great one so far.
Right. So I'm very biased and be upfront about it. So here is the issue about gold. You know, if you really go back before 1973 and especially before 1945, gold was a monetary asset. It ceased being one because the currencies were pegged to the gold. So in a sense, gold functioned like treasuries. Plus, it was uber more than even that, in the sense that, you know, there was always a background fear that people would devalue or get off gold, so which would drive its price even more. But so there are two aspects of it. You held gold, you benefited from the devaluing aspect of it, but also because it was a monetary asset, as long as the peg existed, its value in being a liquid means of settling debt was very high, right? Right now, there is no pegging, right? So it's not a liquid means of settling any liabilities, right? So especially if you look at its behavior during the crisis, and it happened in 2008 as well, its value fell. That's mm-hmm. not for you if you're looking at it from your portfolio and you want to liquidate something to raise collateral. That your collateral value is falling, that's no good. Money is best thing during a crisis. It doesn't fall in value, right? In the short term, it doesn't fall in value. So gold, when it's no longer a monetary asset, doesn't give you that comfort during a crisis. Okay, during the peak crisis, if you are holding a lot of gold, it's not helping you increase your collateral value or raise money. Okay, that's the problem. But from a longer term perspective, it may do it, may not do it, and that's a different call and different people have different views on it. I don't have a strong long-term view on the gold. My view on the gold is always this. if you're going to be really bullish on gold long term, you have to be bearish on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that gold cannot go up when the dollar is relatively strong. It can, because negative interest rates are another factor for gold. But there are two separate regimes for gold. One is the weak dollar regime. The other is strong dollar regime. Gold does well best in the weak dollar regime. So it really is ultimately comes down to the dollar view of the world. And I don't, I mean, as you know, I have already spoken about it, both the dollar and where treasuries are. This is where I stand. I mean, if you're going to take a different view, it has to be on this fundamental basis.
Right.
Going to drive the dollar down. And that's really where the linchpin is.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you look at those correlations over, again, not a 30-day window, but you look at those over, let's say, a five-year time span, I mean, gold and the dollar are very negatively correlated, absolutely. Right. So it makes a lot of sense. If you're going to be long gold, you'd have to have that weaker dollar stance. I want to touch, and if it's just briefly, and just get your thoughts, and it doesn't have to be strong opinions, on what something like Bitcoin could represent, or if it this idea of a non-sovereign, you know, censorship-resistant type digital hedge or longer term potential safe haven for people during, whether it's economic crises or again this idea of broad-based currency debasement, is something like Bitcoin, is that something that attracts you or you see potential value in? Or on the flip side, is that something you don't see a whole lot of use case for, or there's nothing really beyond it that excites you that wouldn't excite you about something like gold?
Right. I mean, you know, the difference between gold and Bitcoin is that gold has been there for a very long time, and central banks still hold a large amount of it. You know, for the reason it gives some official credibility to it, right? And of course, there are Indians who love gold, right? The touch and feel of it, right? So, because Indians sit on, like, I think 40% of world private gold or something like that. It's like huge
amount. Yeah. Yeah. I think them and I don't think China is nearly as big of a market, but I think India is the largest, isn't it? As a percentage, like the personal jewelry too.
I mean, it's just huge. So that's one aspect of it. But you know, see, the issue with Bitcoin is the idea is that we are not going to increase the supply and create a scarce commodity. You know, and by that's what is going to prevent the debasing of it is good in theory. But, you know, the value of the currency just doesn't, yes, of course, if you just print good currency, you know, and give it free to everybody, obviously the value is going to get debased. But that's not what we do, actually, right? I mean, if we did that, it would get debased. We actually do not do that. We would see inflation. We don't do that. I mean, what we do is, if you look at the Fed, it's not giving the currency for nothing, right? I mean, so it's there's no real helicopter money. It's not just dropping money off there.
Mm-hmm.
And our fiscal policy programs are also, you know, in some ways bound. You know, they are not, you know, and you see so much wrangling over it. You know, if it were free money, there wouldn't be any wrangling over it. There is always wrangling. So that's the one thing on the other side of the free. Yes, of course, Bitcoin is a much harder limit, clear, hard limit on it. So that's the attractive part of it for the proponent. The key question is, ultimately, unless it has got a widespread use, value comes from exchange value, and then it develops a life of its own, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the initially it looked like it was trying to become a significant part in transactions, and so that it gets an exchange value, and then it gets a life of its own. And I think there has been a little bit of setback in terms of that. I've not tracked it really that well. I think if, unless it gains sufficient momentum in terms of exchange value, for it to gain the other value, the network externality as a store of value, both are in some ways synergistically tried, but both are opposing each other, because the more it gets value, then it can't be used for exchange. You know,
see, yes.
Problem. The more it gets the speculative value, it goes from 10 to 20,000. I don't want to use it for transaction because, hey, I paid for it and its value doubled. You know, somebody paid for it for pizza 5 years ago and they're ruining that kind of a thing, right? So in the interim, it's actually good for it if it's if it expanded rapidly enough and say that, you know, we are going to have the peak point 20 years from now or 10 years from now. That would be much better, because if it expanded rapidly and its value didn't rise rapidly, then it would gain exchange value. And from that, the network would come. That's my very dilettante view of Bitcoin. Don't take this with any grain of, I would say that I'm a dilettante on this.
No, and I actually think you bring up a number of really, really good points, and ones of which a few of which I agree with. One is the idea of, because there's a lot of talk within, you know, called the crypto enthusiast space of Bitcoin being almost like the one ring to rule them all, right? This global world reserve currency. And from my standpoint, I don't necessarily think it gets there at least anytime in the foreseeable future. Do I potentially see it becoming this alternative global digital store of value eventually? I do actually think it has a decent chance of doing that. But in order to do that, to your point, it has to go through stages and has to achieve a certain monetary value in aggregate and have a certain level of liquidity before it will be used or held by things, entities like central banks, right? I think that's a really good point where you might have some of these fringe central banks that, again, aren't putting in, you're not having $1 trillion, you know, like China's treasury holdings sitting in Bitcoin, right? They just simply wouldn't be able to move in and out of Bitcoin because it just doesn't have that liquidity profile. So I think it goes in stages of its grassroots. You have this really strong retail drive in the early days. Now we're starting to see institutions come into it. And if that institutional investment and sophisticated investor investment can get it to, let's say, $1 trillion, maybe $1 trillion plus, there, I think you could start to make the argument that this thing really, you know, could have legs as a digital alternative reserve, you know, currency or reserve asset. But to your point, a lot of people are saying, you know, central banks will come out and buy this tomorrow under even their mandates or what the definition of a reserve asset or currency is. It doesn't check a lot of the boxes in terms of A, its market value, but B, and probably more importantly, the liquidity of it, because that's when you would want, you know, a reserve asset in general, right?
Yeah, very good. Very good point. Yeah.
And so, I had to ask about, you know, Bitcoin at some point, right? We had to tie it back. We had to tie it back in. So I appreciate your thoughts. I actually really thought, I think they're great ones. I put it out on Twitter right before this, asking for a few questions if people had them. One that I thought was interesting that just came in was relating to the fiscal multiplier. And maybe we can tie this back to the US versus the rest of the world argument. What your opinion is on the fiscal multiplier, especially with all the stimulus coming to market. And I'll add in a personal question of, is the key to jumpstarting economic growth to get hands in the, or to get money in the hands of the lower income and wealth households that have, you know, typically tend to have that higher marginal propensity to consume? What is your kind of thoughts on the fiscal multiplier? Or is that something that, you know, during a time like this, is not going to act as one would expect, I guess you could say?
Yeah, you know, there is a lot of literature that shows that the fiscal multiplier is stronger during recessions, you know, because people are short of cash and spend, give them money, you know, that clearly works. That's one, number one. Number two, if you give the money to people, 40% of the bottom half of the people, they have a lot of needs and they're going to spend most or all of it. Right. Whereas if you gave $100 to Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, it's not like they're waiting, get all that $100, I'm going to spend it immediately. Most of it won't make any difference to whatever their life living standard is. It doesn't get spent. But it doesn't have to be just Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates. You know, I just took those names, but many people are not exactly on the edge, you know. So the money, the fiscal policy, the nature of fiscal policy, who is the money going to and in what way is it going to makes a huge difference to effectiveness. And you saw that most vividly in COVID because we gave so much of the money in terms of the unemployment benefits and $600, and including the stimulus checks mostly went to people making less than $100,000, right? Mm-hmm. So you could see that it really propped up spending, right? Even amidst COVID where there were so many restrictions on spending, it immediately flows back into the economy. So in terms of getting bang for the buck and flowing back into the economy, obviously giving money, the fiscal multiplier is strongest when you give it to the people who are the most needy, you know. But, you know, we have other arguments for, you know, marginal tax rates, you know, all those Laffer curve arguments. Those never work in practice because
right. It's
not what motivates people to. So businesses don't invest because, you know, their marginal tax rate went down. I mean, you know, if you look at most businesses, they say, you know, I have a strong sales. There are people coming in. I can't meet the demand. I have to expand. It's not the marginal tax rate that incentivizes people to expand. It's It's the fact that you have customers. Yeah, you have customers and you have demand. And no business said, hey, you know what? I have a lot of customers, but the margin tax rate is way too high. I'm not investing. You know, I don't, that you have 100% tax rate or 75% tax rate, but I don't think anybody behaves like that. I mean,
Yeah. And to that point, again, tying it back to, you know, debt GDP levels and the conversations right now being floated of how do we, a lot of people just simply asking, how do we pay for this, right? Or whether or not we even have to pay for this. Do you or your team, do you guys have a view on tax policy going forward? Do you think we're going to see higher taxes on the wealthy, on corporations? Do you guys have any opinions there?
No, we don't. We are not political folks. Okay. But I do think eventually growth will pick up, right? Eventually growth will pick up. We have not invested in the infrastructure. We have not invested in many things for a long, long time. And when we come out of, however we come out of it, we will be a long period of strong investment, both domestically infrastructure as well as by companies, because the capital stock is really old. And there will be enough reasons to invest. And so growth takes care of all evils. So when we grow strongly, everything... Mm-hmm. And we will be there. I don't know when, but we will be there.
Yeah, that's a great point. And so I just got one final question for you to kind of tie this entire conversation together. When you look across, again, the global macro landscape, you know, which, whether it's countries or markets, are you and your team most, we'll say, bullish on in the short to medium term, and which ones are you most bearish on? And we can even extend that out to short, medium, long term, however you want to do it, but we'd love to get your take on that.
So in the short to medium term, we are bearish on generally overall. That said, on a relative basis, we continue to be bullish on the U.S. for the reasons I already said, you know, the fiscal stimulus, and we have better balance sheets. We have better capability. Banks are in better shape. Around the world, all things are not enough stimulus. They have gotten hurt more. Private sector balance sheets are worse. Bank balance sheets are in terrible shape. So around the world. In particular, I think a lot of emerging markets are in big trouble because they don't have the capability to do stimulus, you know, because then they will have currency flight, currency weakness, and all that stuff, right? Plus, many of them are not even controlling COVID really well. You know, you see Brazil or even see India, you know. I'm usually always very long-term bullish on India. I am concerned about COVID, to be honest.
No, it seems like, to your point, again, tying it all together, it seems like short to medium term, again, all roads almost, you know, lead back to the U.S. and to the dollar. Because again, whatever you want to say about exploding, you know, debt levels and the unsustainability of those longer term, again, it's all a relative basis, right? Currencies are a relative trade. A lot of people look, you know, the opportunity cost of investing in one market versus another. You know, the U.S. can actually survive, or this dance can go on, I guess you'd say, for a while now, even if it is just the best house in a bad neighborhood.
Yes, yeah, it's the cleanest dirty shirt, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Sri, really appreciate your time. This was an all-encompassing conversation. I really enjoyed it. Excited to have you back on, but thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Kevin. Pleasure.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.